Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Signs with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan, sitting in for Ann this week. Who needs a dog to fight allergies when a cow may be a healthier pet? According to a new study, researchers found that very few children living in rural Amish communities suffer from asthma and allergies. It helps explain one of the common theories for rising asthma and allergy rates in the U.S. Most of us are just too clean. Joining us now from the Allergy and Asthma Network is Dr. David Stukas. Dr. Stukas is also a pediatric allergist and immunologist at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Welcome to All Sides, Doctor.
Thank you so much, Gail. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Well, thank you for joining me. And let's talk about this study. I mean, you weren't affiliated with it, but can you tell us more about its findings?
Oh, absolutely. So we've known for quite some time that there's a prevailing theory called the hygiene hypothesis that potentially explains why we're seeing a rise in number of children with asthma and allergies and things along those lines. And what this basically boils down to is children who grow up in environments in which they're exposed to more and diverse bacteria, they have less risk of developing asthma and allergies as they get older. And we've known that the Amish population, who are exposed to farming environments on a regular basis from infancy, have very low rates of asthma and allergies. What this study did, which is very cool in my humble opinion, is they actually took two groups of very similar genetic backgrounds, so kids who are Amish from very similar ancestries, but who grew up in different communities in the United States. One group from the Amish community in Indiana, and they compared them to another group from South Dakota. And there was one big difference between these two groups. The group in Indiana was grew up in more of a traditional farming environment where they had a lot of dairy cows and they had horses for transportation, things like that, whereas the group in South Dakota relied on more commercialization and technology and machinery to do their farming. And what these researchers found was that the group who grew up in Indiana and exposed to traditional farming methods with more animal exposure, higher bacterial diversity, had lower risks of asthma and allergic sensitization, and their immune response was very different compared to the other group.
What do you mean immune response?
So we have our immune system is involved in a whole lot of different responses to our environment, some of which is protective, some of which causes inflammation and various allergic conditions. And the group that grew up exposed to more bacteria and farm animals had more of a protective response compared to the other group.
Could this study then lead to different ways we treat asthma? We want to put kids in an environment differently when they're younger or take away bacterial soap or something?
Yeah, so it's actually, we're going to go beyond treatment, and this is really looking at prevention. And that's really what some of these wonderful researchers are working on are, can we identify differences in the genetic makeup of some of these children or early life exposures that may actually then prevent the onset of these diseases in the first place?
Do some allergies and asthma have to do still with genetics, or do you think it's both environment and genetics?
Well, we know that parents who have an allergic predisposition or have their own history of eczema, food allergies, environmental allergies, asthma, often have allergic children. So there's a very strong genetic determinant. But we also know that there's a very interesting and complicated interaction of somebody's genetic predisposition or DNA with the environment they're exposed to, even going back to when they're in the womb. So early exposures inside the uterus can actually help target specific genes that may then turn them on or turn them off, which then determines which of these infants develop allergies and asthma.
So you said infants developing asthma and allergies. Is it mostly in children that we see them developing these two conditions?
They're certainly quite common in children, but these can actually develop at any point throughout one's life. So we see a lot of adults who will develop allergies and asthma for the first time, especially if they move to a new environment or things like that. So there's a lot that we don't understand in regards to adults who develop these for the first time. But most of the research, especially for prevention and the hygiene hypothesis, is focused on young children and infants.
So I heard that you can actually grow out of some of the allergies, if not all.
Yeah, some people do. So the lucky ones, there's different patterns you can follow. So there are some children who develop it from early in infancy and when they're toddlers, and then it just goes away during adolescence. We know that we see a big shift. Allergies and asthma are much more common in boys compared to girls, almost 3-1 until they reach the teenage years, and then the ratio actually shifts, and then girls are much more likely to have allergies and asthma compared to boys. So there's some influence on puberty and hormones and things along those lines that can determine determine who may outgrow their allergies or develop them as they get older.
Interesting. We're talking about asthma and allergies this morning and why more and more kids are being diagnosed. If you have a comment or question, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email allsides at WOSU.org. So, Doctor, with this study, and it shows that apparently having in some way environment plays a role, and you talk about prevention, could there be some type of medicine, shot, some sort of vaccine that might actually prevent asthma in folks?
It's actually going to be the reverse. We actually want to expose children to more diverse bacteria and various, you know, endotoxins and things like that. So we don't want to make things cleaner, and that's sort of what vaccines will sort of do, is they'll actually make it less likely that you'll get sick with certain diseases. But we actually want to encourage people to some extent to, you know, not be so sterile in their environment. And there's other studies that have shown that, you know, parents who clean their child's pacifier when it falls out of their mouth by putting it in their own mouth and then giving it to their child, those infants have less risk of actually developing eczema compared to other parents who wash the pacifier with soap and water. So, you know, this is still sort of the beginning stages of understanding this, but I think that all of these different small studies are pointing to a very similar conclusion that sort of dirtier is better in certain ways.
Does that mean that kids play outside more, run in the dirt more? I mean, when you say get dirtier, they don't, you know, a lot of kids don't live on a farm, so this won't apply.
Right. I'm not going to suggest that everybody get a cow and put it in their child's bedroom, although that probably would offer some benefit,
to be honest. The kid would love it. Yeah, the kid would love it.
It's interesting as well because, you know, infants who are born into homes with cats and dogs may have less risk of developing allergies to those pets as opposed to bringing them in later in childhood. And it probably it's related to all the bacteria that they carry and things like that. So, it really is, you know, we've become a very sterile sort of culture, and everybody has their hand sanitizer and gels and things like that, whereas maybe we should loosen the reins a little bit. And when it comes to allergies and asthma, at least, if we know that there's a strong family history, let's not go overboard and try to be as clean as possible. And let's let, you know, kids be kids to a certain extent.
Asthma and allergies, we use them together, but they are two separate conditions. Can you explain?
Yeah, they often go hand in hand because there's very similar sort of responses to the environment with both. But allergies involve the immune system forming an allergy antibody towards things in the environment, such as ragweed pollen, tree pollen, dust mites, cat dander, things along those lines, or food allergies as well. Whereas asthma involves the lungs, and this is a condition that results in reproducible symptoms over time where the airways are very hyper-responsive. And allergies are just one trigger for asthma, but many children and even adults can have other triggers as well, such as viral upper respiratory infections, cigarette smoke, changes in the weather, exercise, hot, humid air, things along those lines.
How do you treat each then?
They're both very treatable, and you know, anybody who suffers from allergies or asthma should strive to have control of their symptoms and not settle for less. But a lot of people, unfortunately, live with frequent symptoms. But a lot of times we have medications. For allergies, we actually have immunotherapy that can desensitize people and potentially cure them from the allergies that they have, and we can reshape the immune response to the environment. We have wonderful medications to help treat and control the inflammation involved with asthma. A lot of these medicines need to be used daily and consistently to offer the most benefit, but they work very well. And then the new frontier is using sort of very targeted biologic treatments where we can actually block the allergy antibody from having the effect on the cellular level. And that's shown great promise for people with refractory asthma, especially.
Is that taken in pill form? Is that a shot? I mean, how do you do that?
Yeah, most of the biologics are going to be shots. So there'll be, injections given every 2 to 4 weeks for basically, you know, prolonged periods of time.
What about asthma? It can't be cured. Like, people can grow out of allergies, but asthma can be treated, but it can't be cured. Am I right in that?
That's correct. We currently have no cure for asthma, but we do have very effective therapies that can control asthma symptoms and ideally prevent exacerbations.
Let me go to a phone here, and this is Bob. You're from Columbus, and you're on the air. Your comment, please.
Yeah, hi. My daughter, when she was a child, she had this horrible cough for years, and the doctor kept telling her to take children's Claritin. And finally, the chiropractor identified it as soy, and we had a really hard time trying to find food that had no soybean oil, but she has grown out of it. But my question is, how much does what we eat have to play in all this? And there's soybean oil in everything now. I'll take the answer after.
Great. Thank you, Bob.
Yeah, so, Bob, you know, I'm glad that your daughter's feeling better. That's, you know, most important. But what you're describing is actually a very unusual phenomenon, and we rarely, if ever, see foods in our diet as a cause of respiratory symptoms. If you have a food allergy, that's going to result in an immediate onset and reproducible reaction with every single ingestion of the food, or typically within minutes of eating it, you're going to develop big red itchy hives and can progress to involve swelling. And you can also have difficulty breathing, difficulty swallowing, things along those lines. But, you know, a food allergen, per se, would be extremely unlikely to cause any type of chronic symptoms. So by and large, most people with allergic rhinitis, environmental allergies, or asthma, we don't need to worry about the foods in their diet as the contributing factor for their conditions.
Do you see going forward then, since we are learning so much about allergies, that it could we could get to the point where we won't see as many kids develop them as we do now? Allergies to so many things.
Yeah, you know, I would love to be out of a job, but I think we're unfortunately years, if not decades, away from finding an effective prevention. We now know that early introduction of some highly allergenic foods such as peanuts to kids at high risk, specifically infants with pretty bad eczema or other food allergy, can actually reduce the risk of them developing peanut allergy.
So that was going to be my next question, is I see peanut allergy everywhere.
Yes. So rates of food allergy have increased over the last couple of decades for reasons that aren't fully clear to us. And along these lines of, you know, with this study in the Amish population, there may be ways to sort of manipulate the immune system early in life in these kids who are at high risk and try to, you know, turn off the allergic pathway. That would be very exciting, and I would love to have that available.
When you say kids at high risk, do you mean genetic high risk or just they start to develop symptoms early or both?
Yeah, there's different ways to stratify risk. One would be, do you have parents who have a history of allergies, asthma, eczema? So we know that you're going to be at higher risk just from the genetic makeup that you have. And then certainly when infants come out, and often will develop eczema early in infancy, which is this chronic relapsing condition where the skin gets very dry and is seen inflamed, those kids with eczema are at much higher risk of developing food allergies, environmental allergies, and asthma. So if we don't have the family history to sort of guide that, usually by 4 to 6 months of age, those kids will often declare themselves as having pretty bad eczema, and we know that they're going to go on this allergic pathway throughout their childhood.
Psychologically, what happens then during an asthma attack, and are we getting better at controlling those for folks?
So I'll answer the first part first. So during an asthma attack, your airways are literally squeezing and tightening to the point where you're not getting air to your body. You're also getting a lot of swelling and inflammation, and there's a lot of mucus that's being produced that you can't clear out of the airways. So you're literally suffocating in extreme examples. Now, thankfully, those extreme examples are rare, although in it's 2016, we still have 5 to 10 people a day dying from asthma attacks in the United States, which in my opinion would hopefully be preventable. Because we do have great therapies that can control asthma and then ideally prevent exacerbations or treat them whenever they occur. This requires a lot of self-management, which is complicated because a lot of times people with asthma don't feel their symptoms until they have those asthma attacks, and so you need to be aware of your symptoms, you need to treat them promptly, and you need to know how to seek care whenever your initial treatment at home isn't working.
So if you're a kid and you're in sports and lots of them are, it's important to have that inhaler there in case they do develop an attack, even though, like you say, they can't feel it until it's there.
That's right. So for anybody with food allergies or environmental allergies or asthma, we have our treatment plans, which consist of a daily plan of here's what you should do every day, even when you feel fine. Most of these are going to be sort of controller medications. But then everybody should have an action plan as well of here's the medicine you should have immediately available at all times just in case symptoms occur, and here's when you should start treatment, and earlier is always better than later.
So much great information, Dr. David Stukas. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Stukas is an Allergy and Asthma Network specialist and a pediatric allergist and immunologist at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Coming up on Wellness Wednesday, we take a look at food addiction and how it's treated. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm Gail Hogan. People often think that tackling obesity is all about eating less and moving more. And many medical experts say in today's world of highly processed, sugary, and fatty foods, it isn't always that simple. For some, food addiction, overeating, and binge eating make the battle for better health even harder. Joining me by phone is the board chair for the Food Addiction Institute, Mark Sharon. Mark, welcome.
Hello. Thanks for inviting me on, Gail.
Yes, it's our pleasure. Let's talk about food addiction. You believe it's like other addictions, tobacco, alcohol. Why don't you define for us what food addiction is?
Well, it's another true substance use disorder. That means that when people get into a pattern of consuming more and more food, something can happen to their brain that changes the chemistry of the brain and makes them more and more sensitive to that food, more and more desirous of eating that food, and they lose control. It can be one or more foods. When some people, it's even volume eating that leads to the same result. But what's important is that it changes what's going on in our brains so that we don't think clearly in the same way we do if we're not over-consuming a particular food for a particularly long period of time. And it's something that we have to deal with the issue by asking, what are your trigger foods? What is it that you find yourself unable to stop eating? And then we have to have a process of selective abstinence, beginning to withdraw the use of that food. And that's something that a lot of healthcare professionals are still only now beginning to appreciate. And so that's the problem we face, that it's not a matter of treating people psychologically. It's not a matter of willpower. It's about taking away the substance in the same way you would take away alcohol or nicotine or any heroin, anything that is a substance use disorder, where it's clear that you wouldn't try to ask someone to consume one of those substances moderately. Yet with eating disorders, that's what we do, and sometimes that's appropriate for people. But for some people, a significant number of people, There is, in fact, this problem of they have a substance use disorder that relates to one or more foods.
Is food addiction mean that your brain is wired differently, or do you develop food addiction?
I think, what people would say is, or what experts in the field would say is that it's chicken egg. It's like it can happen either way. For some people, they are genetically disposed to be susceptible to becoming habituated with one or more foods. And for other people, it can be trauma. In fact, most people that people see with severe food addiction or food substance disorder, they have experienced some kind of traumatic experience in their earlier years. And that so the question becomes, whatever the cause, if we're not removing the substance that leads you to lose control over your eating, then we're not dealing with what you're suffering from. And so it that may be surprising to you to hear that it almost matters more to at least consider that as a possible part of the treatment for this person. Now, does that mean that we don't have to also deal with emotional issues? Of course not. But sometimes it's dealt with in parallel. Sometimes it's dealt with second. First, let's clear, get you clean in the same way we would talk about getting somebody clean from alcohol or heroin. And then, so your mind is functioning better again. And then let's start dealing with the underlying emotional issues that were caused by early trauma.
So some people have trigger foods.
Yes.
And say that trigger food is potato chips, and I don't know if it comes down to a particular food or a type, a category. Do you just remove that from the diet?
That's what ultimately is needed, yes. I mean, now this is for people for whom that is a major component. If there's a biochemical component to what's going on, they have a true substance use disorder related to some one or more foods, for them, it will actually be necessary to remove the food. And, of course, if you tell most people you're going to have to eliminate sugars, even though that's, and they want to turn around and say to you, well, Isn't it true that 80% of processed foods have added sugar? And of course, they're right. And isn't that going to be incredibly difficult? Yes, is the answer. But if it is interfering massively with your everyday functioning, and you've tried diets, and you've tried even 12-step programs, some 12-step programs where abstinence isn't part of the regime, or you've even had bariatric surgery, and it hasn't worked for you, then the idea of giving up one or more specific foods or kinds of foods, because it will make all the difference in your life, begins to make more sense if you have extraordinary support alongside. It's not a matter of just telling somebody, oh, this is what you should do, and they follow the directions, and then that's great. Because your mind is telling you something else. You can't trust it. So you need extraordinary support to be able to begin to stop eating these things that are causing a significant part of the problem. Does that make sense to you?
It does. And it almost sounds like exactly how you treat alcoholism. You have a support system. You have a sponsor.
Uh-huh.
You have a step program. You have meetings. Is this what you're saying?
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Now, there are different food-related 12-step programs, you know, support programs of the kind you're talking about, and some do not insist on or even prominently talk about abstinence. For people who work, you know, with late-stage food addicts, or you know, they would say that's almost amounts to malpractice. Because you're not dealing with the cause, and so people will be in a 12-step program for a long time, and it doesn't seem to be making a difference, and they're following the 12 steps, but they keep eating the foods that are their trigger foods, and that's a problem. So you do have to discriminate. You have to, it's like shop around for a good 12-step program, if you'll pardon the expression, just the same way you would shop around for the right psychologist or physician.
You mentioned that food addiction is something that needs to be diagnosed. Well, what are the signs? How do you diagnose it? Are there symptoms?
Well, there's a thing called the Yale Food Addiction Scale, and it has been, you know, found to have a certain amount of reliability. It doesn't discriminate exceedingly well between food addiction as a substance use disorder and some of the other things that are commonly talked about in the same breath, like compulsive eating and binge eating, and we can talk about that. But what I can tell you is that it asks questions about things like, do you keep eating certain foods even when you're no longer hungry? Do you keep eating things even though it's interfering with other life tasks that are important to you? You know, do you find that eating the same amount of food does not reduce negative emotions or increase pleasurable feelings the way they used to? Those are examples of cues you're looking for in people. But it's very much a matter of loss of control and strong cravings that are hallmarks of food addiction. But then you have the truth is, at this moment, the best way to find out if someone has, a biochemical, related issue is to start trying to identify their trigger foods, start trying to withdraw them from those. And if that starts to make them feel and behave a whole lot better, if they're able to get more control of their eating, if they begin to feel like they're thinking clearly, it's a great sign that what they've been binging on, what their trigger food was, has been causing a significant part of their problem.
Our discussion centers on food addiction this morning. If you have a comment or question, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email allsides@wosu.org. Rose from Columbus, hi. Welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you. I have a history with Al-Anon. I was married to an alcoholic. And I'm not obese, but I have weight issues. And I know that I eat. Because it makes me feel better, and hearing you talk about this about the scale, do you have to go to a therapist to have that evaluated, or what? How's that process go?
Good question.
I mean, it's a good,
Rose.
Very good question. Thanks, Rose. What I would say is that you there are a variety of things you can do. One, we'd always encourage you to talk with a professional with experience in dealing with food addiction, if at all possible. And you should also consider, and you know, you'll find that some medical professionals will actually tell you that they don't believe that such a thing exists, even today, even in spite of studies that show things happening in the brain that are similar to what happens to consumption of cocaine and heroin and so forth, and alcohol. But what, so you have to find someone who is good at dealing with this kind of thing, who can help you decide whether or not, identify whether or not you're doing it. If you just Googled Yale Food Addiction Scale, you can find both a long version and a short version of that right on the internet, just to do a self-assessment to find out whether, gee, this, some of these things really sound like they're what's going on with me. I really should talk to a healthcare professional with some experience and expertise in this field to learn more about my, you know, what I'm dealing with, what I'm struggling with. Because if what you're dealing with is something like a true addiction, you deserve support. You deserve the right kind of help and assistance. It is not something that can be handled with willpower alone. It just doesn't work if someone is having something going on in their brain as a result of the of what essentially amounts to chemicals that they're ingesting. So, is that helpful?
Yes, and I'm sure Rose finds it helpful as well. You mentioned compulsive overeating. Isn't that the same thing as food addiction? Because you said people need to eat even when they're not hungry, and isn't that what compulsive overeating is?
Our ability to define these things carefully and discriminate among them, you know, and again, it's like compulsive eating, food addiction, binge eating disorder, all of those things, it is very difficult. And I would say that the state of the art is not where we need it to be. And so I'm just trying to be very honest with you what you want to find out is what helps this particular person to get control of their eating and improve the quality of their life. And so what you don't want to do is exclude the possibility that there may be some of these trigger foods that are causing you a great deal of trouble. By not testing out that possibility, if that seems to be indicated in your personal situation. As you wouldn't want to say, well, someone told me I have binge eating disorder. They didn't say I had food addiction, so I don't need to try selective abstinence. Well, I wouldn't agree with that. I would say that my understanding from all the experts, clinicians that I deal with from around the world in the Food Addiction Institute is that, you know, you really should consider this as a possibility and work with someone who can tell you whether or not, you know, who can help you actually go through the conversation where you try to identify whether there are, in fact, some consistent triggers, you know, that you know, and with, for some people, by the way, that can be emotional situations, you know, and that gets where it gets confusing. Well, didn't you just tell me it's a biochemical thing? And why would it be an emotional situation would trigger the need to eat certain foods? Well, because it can happen either way. That can be, either thing can be the precipitator of a binge eating or an overeating or loss of control eating experience. And what we know is that those two things interact, and they sort of make things, you know, they reinforce one another, unfortunately, in the way we're all wired.
Are there certain foods that play an important role in food addiction? Are there triggers that seem to be common triggers for people?
Well, you know, sugars for sure. And why is that a problem? One of the things that we were hopeful about is better labeling, right? And so we can look at a product and we can see where sugars occur. And if it's in the top five, one of the top five ingredients, we know there's a lot of sugar. What's the problem with that? There are over 100 different kinds of things in our foods that are actually sugars, but they're called by different names. So how does the innocent consumer know when they're looking through that label whether this has a lot of sugar, that is just by another name? So it's not easy, but the answer is yes, for sure sugar. For some people, white flour turns out to be a problem. For some people, any kind of flour turns out to be a good thing to remove from their diet. Other people, it's salty foods, as you said, fatty foods. So these can all be triggers, and we all, you know, we're all different in what we respond to and what we, you know, one person eats a lot of this, another person eats a lot of that. The problem is loss of control, and the problem is significant loss of control. If this is interfering with your life, if you're starting to pay more attention to what you're going to eat and what and when you're going to get more of this particular food, there's a strong signal there that you need to talk with someone about this and figure out what's going on, because it may be that you have this substance use disorder related to food, a food use disorder.
But it also sounds like someone can try this on their own. If they've identified foods that they really like, to take it out of their diet, and really, what have they got to lose by trying it, I suppose?
Well, I would absolutely agree with that. That's what the clinicians I work with say, that for sure people can try to do that. What we find, though, is that it's hard to do that, that your mind is telling you, oh, I can handle that. I can have just one bag of potato chips or one chip. You know the whole thing about bet you can't eat just one. Well, you know, the problem is that to take something out of your diet that you have been habituated to over a sustained period of time, it's very, very difficult. Your mind does things, and it basically makes bad decisions. And it's not your fault. You're going to feel guilty. You're going to feel awful. But most people need some extraordinary support, whether it's in the form of a 12-step group, whether it's in the form of a professional who operates out of an selective abstinence model and can help you deal with it by meeting with you on a regular basis. All I want you to appreciate is that how very hard it is to actually do that, and that, you know, it harkens back to making people feel guilty. Well, gee, why can't you just stay on that diet? You know, and making people feel it's, if they just had more willpower, they would be able to handle this. Well, not so much. It's just not really true that can happen. And so I just want to caution I want people to try it and see if their thinking clears up and if they feel better. And a lot of people report that they do. But if you continue to find it hard to keep that out of your diet, it's not your fault. It is something going on in your brain, and your brain isn't letting you make that very intelligent decision to keep this one or two or three things out of your diet.
Are there ways for people to find, then, a 12-step program? I don't think it's as easy as, you know, Al-Anon or something.
There are less of them around. What you want to look on the Internet, increasingly you can find, if you just look for Food Addicts Anonymous, Gray Sheeters Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous, just know that you want to ask them, do they believe in selective abstinence? At least that's what our institute advocates.
Selective abstinence.
Selective abstinence. Meaning what I mean is, if you tell people to abstain from food, they think you're a little bit off, you know, because of course we all have to eat to live. But we're talking about selectively abstaining from your trigger foods, the things that you lose control over, the things that you can't stop eating even when you're full, even when you don't, you know, want to keep eating and you keep eating because of emotional reasons, like the caller, you know, Rose suggested. It can be all kinds of things that, with children, with young people, we have a problem of self-soothing by overeating. And so a lot of children get into dealing with emotional difficulties by consuming sweets and more sweets and more sweets. And that's what's going on when they're young. But over the course of a lifetime, that can progress, if not paid attention to and dealt with, into some kind of a full-blown eating disorder or food use disorder that really is a problem.
Thank you very much, Mark. I think you've given a lot of folks maybe something to think about and hopeful that they can find a new way to lose weight if they've been trying so many different things. Mark Sharon is the board chair of the Food Addiction Institute. A pleasure to have you here, Mark.
Pleasure to talk with you, Gail. Thank you. Bye.
And coming up on Wellness Wednesday, bye-bye, a new exercise program is motivating at-risk Central Ohio young people to get up and get moving. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Thank you. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm Gail Hogan, sitting in for Ann Fisher. Motivating kids to exercise can be a tough sell, but a new exercise program is encouraging more at-risk and underserved Central Ohio youth to get active. Capital City Youth Strength and Conditioning offers free or reduced-cost training to local area young people. Joining us in the studio to discuss strength training for kids is the owner and head coach of Ohio Strength Gym, Ryan McFadden. Ryan, thanks for being here. And also joining us is certified CrossFit trainer and founder of Capital City Youth Strength and Conditioning, Laura Sullivan. Welcome to you, Laura.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Laura, let me start with you. What is a Capital City Youth Strength and Conditioning? How did this idea come to you?
So we are a nonprofit organization, and our goal is to engage with youth in the community to get them active, get them moving. So it's a youth development model. It came about from my experience as a social worker and as a CrossFit coach, and just merging those two worlds, knowing the benefits of physical activity for our young kids, especially some of our youth who have some more risk factors and barriers, just this, how we can build into them.
Did you find that kids couldn't find their way to a gym, a safe playground, all those sorts of things?
So a lot of the barriers for our urban youth have to do with safe green space and places they can get out and get active and play. Access to team sport can be an issue sometimes for some of our youth living in lower socioeconomic homes. So just removing some of those barriers and providing them a safe place. And then just in general, youth in general are moving less today. So just making that fun and keeping them moving starting at a young age.
And Ryan, your gym is located in a place where you would be able to reach a lot of these kids, right?
It is. It's an area that's changing a lot, but there's still a lot of folks that don't have access to affordable coaching, affordable training. There's not a lot of really high quality physical activity instruction in the area.
And where are we talking about here in Columbus?
This is an Italian village right down in the Short North.
And so, Laura, this program, do you find that families and kids are very excited about it? It may be the first time they've even had something structured that they can do.
Yes. So the kids that we have been able to get into the gym have been very excited, very engaged. Every day they come back, they're super excited. They light up. They want to show us what they've been working on since they've been gone. One of our barriers right now is just getting out in the community and talking to people and getting them to come to the gym. So just making that appealing to them, because once they're there.
Do both of you do that?
She does most of the outreach. This is really her program. We provide a platform, a facility, a place, and support her in that capacity as much as possible. But she's the one doing the outreach for the youth conditioning.
I bet that's a challenge, though, isn't it, Laura, to try to find the people, reach out to them?
It can certainly be a challenge. What we've tried to do is really get involved with and collaborate with organizations in the community who are already serving youth. So we've partnered with Godman Guild and have kind of piggybacked on some of the programs that they offer, because they're located directly across the street from us. We're going out, knocking on doors, talking to kids, talking to families, doing community events. So we just did the Wineland Park Community Fest, talked to a lot of families there and saw a really good turnout from that. And we also partner with the OSU Star House, so the drop-in center for homeless youth in Columbus, and we've done a few things with the rec centers in Columbus.
Have you found that schools really don't require or offer much phys ed anymore, so there's a lot that these kids don't even necessarily know how to do a push-up or a sit-up?
That's certainly the direction that a lot of schools are moving with funding and other things that schools face. They are removing physical education a lot, so that one outlet that kids did have is sometimes being removed from them. When they come in, they generally know your basic like push-ups and things like that. So they're not missing that completely.
How do you fund your program then? It's a nonprofit.
Yes. So that's a really good question. Right.
And she
now
says to all of our listeners, well.
Well, yes. So right now our program is fully funded through our Ohio Strength CrossFit community. So Ryan provides the space for us, which is a really awesome support. Members at the gym and then friends and family have been really helpful with that. So we have a GoFundMe that you can find on our Facebook page, which we're seeing a lot of support from that. And then we have our large kickoff fundraiser starting. It will be October 22nd. So that will be a community workout. Anyone in the community can participate, really just to bring awareness, raise money. And we are in the process of starting some grant writing. So hopefully that.
So, Ryan, do you see then any parents as their kids come in to, you know, learn exercise and how to really enjoy it. Do you find some of the parents then wanting to come and join the gym or at least start to be interested in physical education?
I know we have a lot of interest in that. There was a parent there yesterday actually observing his son, and he was, I think, very interested in what he's doing and how, you know, the adults can get more involved as well, which is still a challenge for a lot of these adults too, to find that same type of access. And and in that, you know, Wineland Park area, Milo Grogan area down there, there's not a lot of great access for adults in the same situation. So so that's definitely an area that I think we would like to continue to grow, so that it's, you know, it's very kid focused right now, but we want to be able to reach out to other people eventually too.
Well, that's a great idea. If it's all volunteer based, are you the only one, Laura? Do you have other folks that work with you? Or
so I am a one woman operation right now as far as planning and organizing. I have a core group of great volunteers who have been more than willing to drop what they're doing and help. I have one person who volunteers and helps me coach every class. He's there with me and the kids. So that's been really awesome. And we've just seen a lot of support that way. And we're always looking for qualified volunteers, people who want to help, who would like to give back. If they have those skills and talents that they would like to offer, they can definitely reach out and contact us.
Very good. I'm going to switch gears here a little and talk about youth exercise just in general. Why is it important to get kids up and moving when they're young? And I'll start with you, Ryan. Is it important to start those habits early?
Absolutely. That's you learn all your habits when you're young, when you're impressionable, when you're in your teenage years. And not just the psychosocial benefits and making it more of a regular part of your activities and habits, but that's when you start to develop all your bone density. That's when you start to develop a lot of things in your body that are sort of permanent and lasting effects for the rest of your life. And if you don't begin that at an early age, it's difficult to kind of go back and make up for that.
What age do you suggest? And kids sometimes just play outside. I mean, does that count as exercise?
It does, but the trend nowadays is that kids are not playing outside as much. So that's where we're trying to incorporate more structured physical activity and give them a safe place to play. And really, any age is appropriate. It's just the activity itself is going to be slightly modified based on that age group. And I know Laura wants to discuss that a little more, too.
Oh, so to speak to some of the concerns about youth being active and strength training, we first and foremost ensure safety in our program, and that would be the recommendation that's coming down from all of the professionals who are providing information about kid strength training. So we are ensuring that they're safe, and then secondly, that they're having fun. And I know there's a lot of concern about CrossFit and if it's safe for adults, and we always say that intensity is relative. So we're ensuring first and foremost that you're safe and having fun, and then that's when the intensity comes next. And that's different for everyone, and that's the beauty of CrossFit and why I feel it's such a great fit for our youth.
What is CrossFit for people who don't know? They may have seen it and really don't know what it is. Laura?
Yeah, so CrossFit is it's a fitness program, so it's constantly varied functional movements performed at a high intensity. So it's always different, and we are always preparing for different things in life. So we're not doing one set thing. You don't always know what you're doing, and we're just getting up and moving. And Ryan can speak a little bit more to the CrossFit piece. I think he would probably have a lot to offer there.
What I like to tell people is it's like when you're carrying 15 bags of groceries in from the car, or you're helping your sister move to a new apartment or something like that. There's a lot of real world activities where you're going to squat, you're going to deadlift, you're going to do these things that we do in the gym that maybe for 20, 30, 40 years were movements that were kind of vilified, like, oh, deadlifts are bad for your back, squats are bad for your knees. And nowadays they're sort of revisiting a lot of that research and literature and saying, you know, maybe not so much. And maybe actually if you're not doing those things, you're not going to preserve your mobility and your ability to do those things later in life. So we're just trying to make sure that people are exposed to these real world movements, these functional movements, using their body weight, moving large loads over long distances, sometimes quickly, but again, it's all going to be dependent upon a kid's maturity, an adult's maturity and experience with these sorts of activities and training methodologies.
We're talking about fitness for kids, specifically the benefits of exercise and weight training. If you have a comment or question, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email allsides@wosu.org. I would think, Ryan, that CrossFit means just that. It's a cross between maybe some aerobic stuff, some physical stuff, some weight training. Is that part of what it means as well?
It is. We pull a little bit from gymnastics, all sorts of bodyweight calisthenics, swimming, running, rowing, biking, throwing, carrying odd objects such as like strongman type events. So really a little bit of everything.
And you think kids can do CrossFit and that it would be good for them to do?
Absolutely. It's fun for them because, like, even as adults, we go in there, it's like we're playing, we get to move these balls and heavy sandbags and kettlebells and dumbbells and different things in ways that you don't see in a lot of traditional gymnasiums. And that's kind of what's attractive for a lot of kids, as well as it's different. It's unique, it's different, and we can build a lot of games around that, which are fun too.
Part of it is weight training, Laura, and there's a back and forth between whether this is good for kids at an early age or whether they should back off. What do you think?
I think it's absolutely great for kids, and a lot of research and literature is showing that today. The literature that suggested it was poor really has been debunked and been proven otherwise. So by providing strength training for children, we are able to increase their musculoskeletal strength. So they are building muscles as they're growing, and they are building the strength to support those muscles as they're growing. So if you think about a child who's playing sports, if they are running and playing soccer and are moving constantly with their knees, if their knees are stronger because in a controlled environment they were able to strengthen their knees, then they're going to be less susceptible to sports injury and or injury in daily life. And that's really what a lot of research has shown. And as far as safety and strength training, the research has shown that most injuries that happen during strength training are occurring when children aren't being supervised and they're not with an adult or a trained adult. So the benefits certainly outweigh the risks, especially when you're speaking about a controlled, safe environment.
Would you suggest then if somebody wants to start weight training with their child of 5, 6, 7, that they really do it with a professional?
Yes, and I think a professional is good, but I think also we have to talk about the idea of weight training.
Right.
So
what do we mean by that?
Yeah, so a 5 or 6-year-old weight training would not look at all like a 12-year-old or an adult. So when we're talking about children and specifically starting them young, that looks a lot like body awareness and body control and just moving with an object in your hand. So that object, what we use at Capital City and at Ohio Strength, is a PVC pipe. So just an empty hollow pipe that they hold just to get their body in a right position holding something without any load. So that would be strength training with a 6-year-old, 7-year-old. And it's not until technique is really sound and they're really able to understand what they're doing and how to move their body that there would be any load added. And speaking of those children at a young age, there's certainly not a heavy load added.
What would you suggest then, either of you, as the best age to start weight training, even as you say, body awareness training?
Typically, most literature is going to say around 6 or 8 years old, but it really is so highly dependent upon emotional maturity. I think most parents know they may have a couple different children, and one child is far more ready for things at the age of 5 or 10, and another child might not be ready at those ages. So it's all about, can they follow instructions? Can they listen? Can they focus? Can they pay attention? Do they have the body awareness that Laura spoke of to understand how their body is moving in space? Do they have balance and coordination and those sorts of things? So it's kind of just a little give and take where you're watching your child develop, you're watching them perform some of these activities and starting to see if they're ready to move on to that next step.
But Laura, isn't there a danger of burnout, just like anything else? If you start them so young, by the time they really can lift the weights and all those things, when they really need it, they are done with it.
That could be a concern in any sport or any physical activity. So like I said, safety is first for us, but fun is a really close second. So anytime the kids are in the gym, we're keeping it fun. They're not in there and thinking of it like this PE class that they don't want to show up to. We're playing games. So during our warm-up, we play a game, and we keep that really active and fun, and we're talking the whole time. We'll do our strength piece, which is generally really short. So the key with kids to keep them from burning out in that class or in the future is just short intervals that they can digest. So 5, 7 minutes, and then we're moving on to the next thing, and we're checking in, like, what are we going to do next? Like, what game? And at the end, as long as the class, like, we usually have time at the end. Each participant usually picks a movement that they want to do, and we'll turn it into some sport. Form of a race. And they really enjoy that. So keeping it fun for them is the most important.
Thank you both for being here. That's all the time we have this morning. Laura Sullivan, certified CrossFit trainer and founder of Capital City Youth Strength and Conditioning. Thanks for joining us, Laura.
Thank you.
And Ryan McFadden, owner and head coach at Ohio Strength. Thanks to you as well.
Yeah, thank you.
And thank you all for listening. It's Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.